This week's TPM podcast is with Steve Phillips, founder of The Jordan Legacy. Today we talk about topics such as mental health in the workplace, the old Victorian education system that's still in place today, and suicide prevention, listening to his story about his own experience and what led him to set up The Jordan Legacy.
First and foremost, why don't you tell me who you are, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Yeah, well, Steve Phillips. I'm a man in my early 60s, we'll say, who had a plan at the end of 2009, or as we approached December, to take my consultancy business, where I worked in sales and business development, particularly around social media, the business end of social media, how companies from Deloitte and Harley Davidson and Toyota and other companies I work with would engage with social media platforms to attract new business and build relationships with existing markets. I met with a consultant towards the end of November to discuss really an exit strategy for my business with a view to carry on with my work in corporate speaking, but kind of tail back a little bit and move into some kind of retirement, whatever that meant. And then on December the 4th, 2019, having just left a client, a large automotive group in the Midlands, I receive a call from my son Jordan's girlfriend, Charlotte. And in that call, my world changed in an instant as she explained to me that she got back to Jordan's house and discovered he'd taken his own life. And in that moment, everything that I had planned and thought I knew was going to happen with my life just changed completely.
It's, you know, obviously very sorry to hear that. And it's something that unfortunately, and it is very unfortunately, a lot of people are hearing more about now. Facing themselves, which is a terrifying concept in itself. And I think, you know, as someone myself, and this is certainly not about me, as someone that has had, you know, severe mental health problems over the years in terms of depression and dealing with things like anxiety, you know, I can't even begin even from that level to understand where or how you were feeling at that time when you received that news.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, I was asked the question the other day, really, and I can go back to that moment because it's documented. I've been very open to a global audience, really, in terms of sharing my story, and I can tell you the conversations, the exact time the call came in, who I phoned in what order, and going back into the offices of the client before even considering making a 3-hour journey back home. I can kind of tell you all those moments in terms of how I was feeling. That's kind of an odd one for me to try and get my head around, because clearly it was shock. It has to be. But it's really hard to kind of recall just, you know, what was I feeling? I mean, it has to be just shock, I suppose, really.
And how old was Jordan at this time?
Jordan's 34. Yeah, in fact, we had his 36th birthday just this Sunday gone.
Mm. Yeah, so I'm 34 this year. And it is one of those that you have to reflect on as an individual. And, you know, for the longest time, I, prior to the pandemic, took part in a men's mental health group in my village, which was focused around, its only goal was to prevent at least one person in the entire village from ever even considering going down that pathway. Mm. Mental health is obviously a topic that has become a little bit more prevalent now with the pandemic and the whole work from home situation. I read a study this week, which was anywhere between 78%, and depends how you analyze the data, and 98% of people want to work from home permanently going forward. And the pushback I get on the few that don't want that is, you know, the mental health angle. And my take personally is that the mental health angle was a lot worse when we couldn't go out to do anything whatsoever. However, now you could potentially work from home, but still be able to go out, pubs, restaurants, see friends and so on. So how has mental health affected sort of what you're seeing day to day at the moment in the world? You know, are you seeing that it's a big struggle?
Yeah, without question, there are kind of two sides as well to what I'm doing. I deliver quite a number of workshops to larger organisations in the UK and Europe, where we're talking about employees and this return to work. And there is very much a divide between those that kind of have got very used to the flexible working at home, would like to continue, and those that want to come back to the office. But those that do want to come back also have their own fears and concerns about what will that environment be like? How safe will it be? What about the commute if I'm in London? All these things are concerning them. You know, how will my colleagues behave? Will, you know, whatever the company has put in place in terms of social distancing guidelines and protection, you know, will my colleagues adhere to those? So there's those kind of concerns. And then, you know, on a daily basis, really, the people that are just kind of struggling, the long period of time of being disassociated from their family and relatives and not being able to see people, and from young children, you know, this impact of them not being able to see their friends and go to their parties. And of course, this is increasing now with the cases rising of COVID again. You know, I'm speaking to people on a daily basis that are in really challenging situations. In fact, just prior to our call, I've been making a call to the MD of a company, as one of their employees have been in touch with me over the last few days. And I got a message last night that was enough for me to say, right, somebody needs to step in and see if this lad is okay. You know, when I'm seeing a picture of sent to me in a message of two-thirds empty bottle of Jack Daniels and a packet of paracetamol, you know, and this is what's happening. You know, it's we've got the statistics. We know that, you know, the one person every 40 seconds takes their life. 800,000 people globally, 6,591 in England and Wales in 2019. Statistics are kind of interesting because you look at them and go, wow, that's awful, or you interpret them however you say. But when you're daily talking to people that are going through this struggle, you think this is an issue, because I'm not talking to someone who's just had a heart attack every day. I'm not talking to someone who's just told me they've got cancer every day, you know, but I am having these conversations. So, yeah, a lot of people struggling out there at the moment.
And there isn't one single thing, of course, but what would be something that you would recommend to most employers at this stage, you know, where we are in the cycle of the pandemic, if you will? What's one thing you could give to employers to perhaps help them over the next couple of months as far as all of this is concerned?
Yeah, it's interesting you say, what can we give to employers? Because I think we have to realise that, you know, employers have got a lot of pressure on them already. And you are saying you've got to do better for your employees. You've got to look after their mental health and their well-being, and yet the employers themselves are struggling in many cases. So I think, you know, firstly, what support is there for the employers themselves? That's really important. Who's kind of taking care of them? I think the other thing that I'd say is don't just leave this well-being project, whatever you would want to call it, to HR. This is a responsibility for everybody within the organization. And I think it's incumbent upon us as employees, as line managers, as directors, to get a much better understanding of mental health. You know, what does good mental health look like? Mm-hmm. Okay, that will allow someone to perform. What does poor mental health look like? And if I kind of recognize that, what do I do in that situation? Part of my job now, Sean, is to go out and educate and say, you know, it's all our responsibilities to look out for our colleagues and our teams. So in directly answering your question, what we've got to do is start to make mental health and well-being part of our everyday culture and not an event that happens once a month.
We've just concluded last week, I believe it was, we just concluded at what we call our 7 pillars of wellness. And we've got a HR team, which we refer to as people operations. And it was for 7 weeks, each week a different theme, and each one of those themes every day a different activity. And it was interesting how the desk yoga, the walks around the countryside property on which our offices are based, and the meditation have all become fixed weekly recurring events in the company calendar now, whereby everyone takes part. And that to me, to have the directors want to get involved in that and sit in the meditation and, you know, put the phone down for the 10 minutes that it takes. And it's not just, you know, the younger ones who maybe want to have a 10 minute break. It is everyone throughout the organization taking part. That to me means the world.
Yeah. And look, you know, congratulations on that, because I think this is what it's about. It's part of our culture. It's part of what we do now. And I think if companies can get to that level and realize the importance of this, you know, it's, you know, I think we've gone beyond the days of meditation and yoga being a pink and fluffy thing to do, which, you know, hippies, you know, did once upon a time. I think we recognize now that things like mindfulness and quiet time are so important. And you know, I remember speaking to, in one of the sessions I was running with a large manufacturing company in Europe, and talking to their employers and saying, what do you feel needs to change? What are your concerns about a post-COVID world when you go back to work? And one of them said, you know, one of the benefits of having work from home is that I can intensely focus on my work at times and be really productive. But I can also step back. I can go and have kind of lunch in my garden. I can go and sort the washing out, walk the dog, or, you know, fit all that in. The challenge when I come back to the office is I'm switched on from the minute I get in there to the end of the day. I can be standing in a lunch queue, you know, just having a thought, and someone will come up to me and say, oh, yeah, sorry, buddy, but, you know, and this is a thing that quite often in an office environment we're switched on. So to take those 10 minutes, you know, or at any period of time, or go and have that walk, managers taking a walk with their employees or whatever it would be, and just talking about kind of how you're doing, you know, how are you doing, how are things generally, and taking that care in consideration. We know the stats are there. We know the stats are there for the companies that have a really effective well-being culture in place, that employees are far more productive. And it's really about creating, you know, what this term now has been used a lot, you know, a psychologically safe place to work in. And again, a lot of studies that were done by a professor post the Chernobyl accident many years ago, where the term psychologically safe working came from, was that 31 people died in the Chernobyl accident, but over 4,000 died as a result of the impact of that afterwards. And what it was, and there was also then this culture where people feared making mistakes. Someone had made a mistake with disastrous consequences. What happened then, the really productive people also had this huge amount of stress and anxiety placed upon them, to not make a mistake in delivering outcomes. So what happened is that you know, these people weren't productive because they feared making a mistake. So what we have to do in the workplace is create this psychologically safe environment where it's okay to speak up. It's okay, you know, I'm struggling, I'm not sure about this or whatever, but where we have these cultures in some businesses are just totally focused on outcomes. Then, you know, we need to change the way we approach that, I think, and the way we kind of look after the well-being of people so they can thrive and be productive.
And I think that was one of the main areas and reasons for rebranding our HR to people operations, was the humans are not simply resources in the business. They're not just cogs, numbers, whatever they are, right? They are people that operate within a company and operate together. And that's our huge thing. And we did the same as everyone else during the pandemic, which was the Zoom calls, the Friday beers on Teams and all that kind of stuff. But nothing quite beats that interpersonal and understanding people's own mental space as well as their mental health. And we invest a lot of money in technology to understand our people's mental state, I suppose, as well as performance. And every week start conversations with those that report to us with how are you feeling and how are you doing? And it's not the fluffy, it's not the, you know, the hippie that people once believed those sorts of questions used to be. It is genuinely caring for the people that are within your organization. And I feel that still lacks in a lot of the bigger companies. Mm-hmm. It's still difficult to get that across.
I think you're right, and you know, we know that for many, because we hear this internally from the employees, that they you know, many employees feel that companies, you know, have this wonderful mission statement and value. We value our employees and their well-being, but quite often it's little more than a tick box exercise.
Exactly. So tell me about what the main priorities, I suppose, or the pillars of what the Jordan Legacy is about. What are your aims there? And, you know, really, what are you trying to achieve with it, I guess?
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey for me, Sean, because as I say, from the moment I kind of published my story in an article on LinkedIn, which got a huge global response, and suddenly I got this outpouring of people, from psychologists to people that had lost loved ones to suicide, to those considering taking their own lives. I suddenly, you know, started to get messages from people, and those that were struggling and were kind of looking to me for help. You know, immediately I kind of thought, well, hang on, I'm not a mental health professional here. How do I deal with this? So initially I recognized that I had a voice on LinkedIn. It's something I'd had before because that was my industry and my sector. So how would I use that? You know, what was my whole purpose for even publishing that article, I suppose? And in that moment, when I talked about the ripple effect and the whole outcome and the devastation and just what we were dealing with, it was really to get a message to anyone who was considering taking their own lives that this is kind of what you're going to leave behind. Whatever you think you're going to leave behind, you want to multiply that 100 times, because it will be beyond your wildest comprehension. And it worked, because I got people coming back to me saying, look, I was considering, I was in this position just a few days ago, I've read your article, I just can't do this to my family, my friends, or whatever. So it had that impact. So initially the Jordan Legacy was, all right, is this kind of what I'm going to do now? I immediately kind of lost the passion for what I was doing before. It seemed to have a little purpose for me. So the Jordan Legacy was going to be created initially with the view to it being a signposting website, resources just to help people. There was no clear plan. But as I started to have these conversations online, I started to attract one or two people that had significant experience of working in the suicide prevention sector. And that led to a couple of conversations where I started to learn a little bit more about the zero suicide community globally. It's not an officially registered brand, but it's a group of people that believe essentially that we should be working wherever possible towards a zero outcome, knowing that it's never going to be a realistic achievement. But as long as we're working towards that, we're going to increase the number of times we save lives. Whereas we have, in our country, certainly fairly institutionalized low ambition, I dare I say, from our governments and the NHS combined, where they would suggest their five-year forward plan should aim to reduce suicides by 10% in 5 years. And you are really 10%? So what about the other 90? What are we going to do about them? So we've got this issue. So what I learned was, from successful case studies globally, was where you have a ground up strategy where you involve the business world, corporate businesses, local businesses, and local communities, you can, if you can mobilize them towards practical solutions and practical actions, you can make a big difference. And you can, and case studies are out there from Detroit and MerseyCare and Australia, you can get to a zero number in terms of certainly people known to the mental health system. I would appreciate some people fall outside of that, of course. So when we put what we call our transformational model together, it was fairly ambitious, really. It was to look at kind of four areas that had worked well in other places. And that was go out to the community, schools, clubs, pubs, bars, small SME businesses, chambers of commerce, have a discussion with them. How important is this? What's your experiences? Would you like to be involved? What could you do in a practical, from a practical perspective to make a difference? We would then talk to the larger corporate businesses, the second layer. So the workplace, what's happening in your workplace cultures? Let's have those conversations. What are you doing? What can you do to make a difference there? Do you have a zero suicide or a do no harm plan in place? What's that? We've never heard of that. Okay, well, we can help you with that. If you said about going out to the digital and the tech environment, we recently ran an online, the fourth of our online conferences this year, where we attracted the digital and tech community. And that was really about life-saving systems, digital and human. How can we apply digital with human support to save lives? And of course, we had people from North America and the UK on the panel that were talking about apps and real-time reporting on suicides and, you know, what's happening in the tech world at the moment and what could happen. And again, we had another 300 or 400 people attend that session to debate. And the fourth area was the design out layer. And that is really about talking to construction companies, architects, surveyors, and saying, we know people choose bridges, buildings, car parks, other public spaces to take their own lives. We know they research them, often going there several times before they take their lives. What are we doing to design out for the future that ability to take your own life? Right now, I can tell you can put a barrier up or a sign or whatever, make that bridge look really quite ugly in the process. What's your thinking around the future? And there are many forward-thinking architects and design companies that are looking at this, and there's some great examples. And I think we had 430 people attend that online conference, and some really eminent architects talking about the work that they're doing and social housing. And I think what these conversations were doing, Sean, they were really stimulating people's thinking to say, some of the architects I spoke to in the lead up to the event said, I hadn't even considered that we would design out the ability for suicide. Take a building, take an office block. We have safety catches on windows to stop people accidentally falling out. Okay, so what are we doing to stop people deliberately jumping out? Oh, wow, I hadn't thought about that. So, you know, one of the really exciting developments this year so far is that for that particular layer of our strategy, we have partnered with a lady called Dr. Liz Walder. She's a really eminent architect, has the close ear of the Welsh government where she's based, and Westminster. And from recent conversations, it looks like she's very close through the work that we're doing to be able to get a change fundamentally to the building regulations in England and Wales that design out of suicide must be a part of the process. Now, if we just achieve that this year, that would be massive, absolutely massive.
I think that's tremendous. And I'm curious where the sort of idea of even approaching architects and builders came from for this, because, you know, what most people won't know or appreciate or even think about day to day are things like that. I had a good friend of mine who ended up in a mental health ward and on suicide watch a few years back. And I remember visiting and being told, well, these things are slanted in a particular way so that they can't do X. This is missing, you know, a particular type of handle or a particular type of, you know, knob or whatever it was to prevent Y. You go, actually, that's really smart. But again, it's limited to those specific areas, when in reality, a lot of this, like you say, happens in the home, or it might happen on bridges or wherever it might be. And you're right. How did that even become a thing that you considered? Was that as a result of Jordan, or was this just outside factors?
This was, you know, conversations with people globally in the zero suicide community, and some of the evidence-based case studies that have been out there, the most famous of which was from Detroit, I think between 2004 and 2007, where they employed this community-based approach with these different layers and actually got the numbers down to zero known to the mental health system. So the evidence is there, the case studies are there. There are companies already considering this, as I say, in the UK, and we had some of them on board showing, you know, just if you consider a bridge, even a railway bridge or a road bridge, you know, most people think, okay, well, is it about how you design the bridge itself then? So you make the parapet higher so they can't get up there. And you say, well, it goes beyond that. It's the lighting leading up to the bridge. It's the clearing away of trees and access around a bridge so that people that are regularly visiting that area in their research, because again, we know that happens, people will visit several times, they're seen. You know, we put a camera on, we can see that they're coming back and they're visiting. So it's that whole design around the bridge and the location that has to be considered. And, you know, there's some Network Rail and other organizations are doing some great work, you know, with that thinking process in mind. So, so yeah, I mean, it's not something we've got to start in a way, but we've got to increase the awareness as we're doing today that these things are happening and can happen and should happen at a much greater level.
You made a very good point earlier about, you know, it's one thing to put up signage about these things, right? And I know it's often joked about when you go into hotels now, when you see the hairdryer with the little tag on it that says don't use in the bathtub, right? We joke about those things as being, well, of course you wouldn't do that. And signage can be seen that way or taken that way. But the reality is if you build these elements into the design of things, it's not dumbing down human nature. It is protecting and preventing, you know, sadly, something that's so very prominent now, I guess.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, right now we have bridges built, we have buildings built, and you think, well, we've got to do something. And the most famous story, of course, I think, is the Golden Gate Bridge in the States that we're seeing huge numbers of suicides weekly. And debates were raging in that area about, well, what do we do about this? And all kinds of quite expensive suggestions and ideas were made until somebody apparently just came up and said, why don't we put a net underneath it? Someone said, okay, yeah, we could do that. And that's what they did, you know. So you want to jump up? We're going to catch you in a net. So, all right, well, there's no point in me coming here then. So at least we, you know, they made that impact. So it can be really, simple solutions sometimes. But of course, for the future, we need to be thinking about the way we design outdoor places.
So I have to ask, because obviously so much of your work has been prominently around social media, you know, the impact of social media and mental health, the impact on social media and suicide, I guess, you know, the two are so closely linked.
Yeah, they are. And I think we've got to, you know, I've shared a post on LinkedIn this week about not demonizing social media, because I think we have to look, as with everything in life, at the good and the bad. So on the one hand, we have a generation of young people being brought up extensively on social media and seeing their own lives through the lens of other young people who apparently are doing so much better than them and look far more attractive than them. And we know this is contributing hugely to the poor mental health of many young people out there at the moment. But equally, there will be some really positive social media sites and platforms out there that are engaging young people in the right way. But we know there is this issue that certain social media platforms are starting now. I think Instagram is the most recent one that will now start identifying in one of the countries, I think it's Norway, if I remember rightly, that if a photograph has been touched up or enhanced, words gone totally out of my head now, filtered, it will be labelled as such. And that's happening in Norway at the moment. That's a law they brought in over there for the social media platforms. On the other side of the coin, had an example this weekend where we saw a really concerning post from somebody on LinkedIn, quite clearly was signing off. And that prompted an immediate response. This was late Saturday evening. And a number of people, and I've been alerted to it, and a number of other people were, right, what do we do? And in the space of the next hour, somebody managed to find this person's phone number, managed to contact the police in the area, got an incident number, the police went out. And the following day, we discovered she was okay, clearly struggling, was going to get some help. And you think, well, that's the, you know, the power of networks and social media for good as well. I think at the moment, I think we have to proceed with caution with social media because we are consuming too much of it. We're seeing a life that often isn't real. We very rarely share our true selves on social media. We show the happy parties or the night out and all these things, and it's all glammed up, but we won't show our true selves there. So I think there is, you know, a need to really look at how we engage with social media, and particularly how young people engage with it for their own mental health and well-being. Otherwise, we're creating a generation of young, anxious people who become older, anxious adults, really.
I had a 22-year-old employee come in to see me about a year ago, broke down in tears, was struggling enormously, and it was related to social media influencing their thought process and patterns. And it was at 22 years old, I don't yet own a sports car, I don't yet own a holiday home, let alone a first home, but I don't own a holiday home, and I'm not traveling the world, and I'm working 9 to 5, and I don't understand why I failed so badly, and proceeded to quit the company. We managed to bring this person back and get them back up. But seeing that what you follow online influences your thought process and your life and your choices and decisions to that degree is terrifying.
I agree. And you've just summed up the situation. This is exactly what's happening to so many people right now. That you know, I spoke to a young 19-year-old young lady who herself has depression. She has antidepressants. She has the additional burden and challenge that she comes from an Asian community where there's a huge amount of stigma. Her father even is questioning her taking the antidepressants. You know, it's not what we do. And she started to talk about the young people, and we had this conversation about their struggles. I said, why, what is it, do you think, that is creating this situation where young people are taking their own lives and really struggling? And she said, it's one word, it's competition. I said, well, just explain that to me. What do you mean? She said, well, take my, you know, I've got a 14-year-old brother. The standards and targets within schools at the moment are beyond what I experienced 5 years ago, she said. So he's under this huge pressure to achieve targets. And if you don't achieve them, you personally have failed already. And then, of course, he's faced with the prospect of going on to university if he gets his exams. You've got more pressure and more competition there. You've got the added challenge then of the student loan debt that goes with that. And then the thought, particularly if you're living in a city area such as London, okay, if I leave here, will I get a job, first of all? If I do get a job, will that allow me to buy a house, even get on the housing ladder? If I do get on the housing ladder, will I ever afford a holiday or a nice car? And then she said, just add to that what they're seeing on social media, where suddenly someone apparently has created a YouTube video and become a millionaire, apparently. Or they look at this person and go, they've got a better nose than me, a nicer nose or whatever. And all this huge competition to be better than we apparently should be is just huge. And it becomes, I think you've summed it up perfectly with that 22-year-old employee. That is what's happening.
And I think, you know, the premise of social media is that we all PR, and it is PR ultimately, we PR the best versions of our life. And it is immensely fake for most parts. I don't do social media other than LinkedIn. I don't have apps on my phone. I don't have the accounts. I don't do it. And for me personally, at age 28, was the peak of my materialistic life. I had every toy you could want. I was very well set in life as a result of business and other factors. And I just said, this is where I'm actually the most unhappy in my life. And I gave away, donated, threw away probably 90%+ of my possessions and goods. And now I wear a de facto uniform of either a white or a black t-shirt and jeans. I own 10 pairs of the same white t-shirt, 10 pairs of the same black t-shirt, and very much live what I call a minimalist lifestyle, because it's less choices. I'm not competing with anybody, and I don't have to worry, you know, does this compare to that? Does this work for that person's opinion? And that's my way of trying to avoid that, I suppose. And everyone has their own tools that they need to develop themselves, I guess.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and at the risk of kind of throwing back questions to you now, Sean, on your podcast. Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because you had obviously reached a point of recognition at 28 where you went, I'm unhappy, but instead of going the route that a large number of people going, you were able to make kind of some practical changes and practical decisions where you were kind of happier in life. Do you think that's because behind all that you had the confidence that you kind of had succeeded and therefore were able to step back from that, where others are thinking, I haven't succeeded? I don't know. Just I'm kind of interested in how maybe you were able to make the choices that you did.
I think it's a mixed bag. I think by the age of 28, I'd exited my previous business, which I'd run for 10 years. And so I had garnered some degree of what most people would recognize as success. And that had worked for me, but that place had put me in such a deep, dark hole that it was, I had considered the alternative, and I'd been very open in chats with my employees about this. You know, I have gone down that dark path before, but I knew that I didn't want to leave certain people and certain things behind. And that was the thing that at 28, I'd just become a father. And for me, it was an immediate, well, I need to find something that fixes me ultimately, or helps me through this process. And there was always a huge weight, and what you've said there about competition, I suppose, was a lot of it. There's a huge weight about having the nicest car. I had a Porsche at the time. I had nice toys, nice, you know, everything that you'd want. And ultimately for me, it was, I'd rather pull back and be less known, he says with a podcast, be less in that race to try and, I can't remember who said that quote about, you know, we buy things from, that we can't afford, to oppress people we don't like and so on and so forth, right? It doesn't interest me at all, at all.
And I think it's a really important point that I think we have to, you know, if you look at this, I don't want to call it a pandemic. A lot of people have used the term in terms of mental health, but you know, clearly we you know, we 1 in 4 people in this country are experiencing a mental health issue of some kind. You know, clearly we've got an issue, and suicides are not going down, and arguably are they going up? Well, I don't think we're going to know that data for another year, possibly. But you know, where do we need to start? Because an organization like the Jordan Legacy is very much looking to prevent suicide, but I think the journey has to go way back before this. We don't want people to even get to the crisis situation in the first place. So I think it starts with the young people. And I think if we, you know, right from early age at school, can start to give and empower children to say, look, it's kind of okay to be me, you know, and that's kind of enough. And if I am successful, that's kind of a bonus in life. But to try and instill, you know, some real values in kids about what is important in life instead of this competitive environment that they're in, where, you know, Dr. Ken Stevenson, I think, who now sadly passed away, the great educator who talked a lot on YouTube, who just said, you know, we're working in a Victorian education system that hasn't changed, and it's all focused on outcomes and achievement. We need to change it, fundamentally need to change our education system to prepare kids for life, with academic qualifications being part of the process rather than the other way around. And that's I think where we can make the big future differences with kids in school, but a lot of work to do there.
I love what you just said there about how it was all focused around outputs. There's a great venture capitalist in the US, a guy called Brad Feld, that I followed for many, many years. And he did a fantastic article a few years back talking about reducing the inputs. Stop focusing so much on the output necessarily, because output should be quality-based, not volume-based anyway. But input should be the same. And we get so much input and so much stimulus, I suppose, on an everyday basis, that incessant scrolling through social media, that it never ends. It's an infinite scroll. And so a lot of what I do is to reduce, personally for me, is reduce inputs. So, you know, in my home, I have no TVs in my home. Oh. I read a lot. I don't engage with social media. Whilst I have a son, yeah, we have an iPad that he can watch occasionally movies on, but it's more focused around quality inputs. What can we go and do? Where can we go? What, you know, and so on and so forth. But I think that the education system certainly needs a kick up the backside when it comes to understanding emotional and mental health. The big factor I'm seeing with my son starts school in September, and understanding that when it comes to things like religion, they're not just taught the religion of, you know, perhaps where they were born, but there's also, you're being taught religion around the world. You're being taught not just the geography of where you live, but geography of around the world and history of around the world. But they don't teach you necessarily about the things that are to do with yourself or help you. You know, the financial education at schools is non-existent. They don't teach you how to manage money. They don't teach you how to do a budget. They don't teach you any of those necessary life skills, which are far better than understanding how to do long multiplication in life. And in that same breath, I feel truly that there needs to be a big focus on emotional and mental well-being for kids, especially those now that are going back to school after what's happened over the last year or so.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I read another statistic, last year, that said, you know, 50% of the mental health issues that people experience in adulthood are kind of formed during those young years, around 7 to 12 years old. And I absolutely agree with you. We've got to, you know, support children around their emotional well-being, their resilience in life. That needs to be the focus. You're absolutely right with long multiplication. But we've got calculators now. I'm sorry, but, you know, we have some diehard educators. They go, yeah, but that's not, you know, look, they're there. You know, we use them. I'd much rather have a life skill that taught me how to deal with a challenging situation or in life and how to overcome that and deal with it emotionally and practically than you know, sit there working out long multiplication. That's only because I was hopeless at maths, by the way, and stared at the blackboard in utter confusion usually.
I think one of the things that, you know, we always try and do better, the next generation always tries to do better than that before them, and parenting especially, I suppose, we always try and do so much for our children better than what our parents were able to do for us, I guess. And I think I always remember that the stigma around things like counseling or therapy or asking for help, you know, in the US, everybody's got a therapist. Everybody's in therapy every day of the week. You know, that's how it comes across because it's so open to discuss. Mm. Same in business in the US. Until you've failed six times, you're not a businessman yet, because you fail and you bounce back and you learn. In the UK, we're far more reserved. We're far more, you know, maybe it's that stiff upper lip mentality, I don't know, but we can't talk about failure. We can't talk about things going bad in our life. And God forbid we talk about asking for help or seeking help. And I recall when I started going to therapy for a number of issues, I was 18 years old when I started. And I remember my father, who I don't have the best relationship with, I remember him saying, why are you going to therapy? You grew up in a very nice life with some very nice things around you. Never wanted for anything. There are people out there that have got it far worse. And you have to think, if that's the sort of message that we're portraying to people, there's no wonder a lot of people will never seek help. And I tell anyone that works for me, and there's been a couple of people in the past year, 18 months, where I said, you need to go talk to somebody.
Yeah.
And we'll support you with that.
Yeah. I think the message here is, you know, poor mental health doesn't discriminate. You know, you can be the wealthiest person financially or the poorest. When it comes to mental health, you're in the same room, essentially. And I think that, you know, potentially those that have grown up in the nice environments, had everything, are often only being set up to think, well, I kind of need to go out and achieve the same now. So the pressures are arguably greater. And we know this from some of the poorer countries in the world, where people have very little in terms of physical possessions in their life, and yet are often the most happiest of people. And, you know, it's fascinating, some of the reading I've done around that. You think, well, you know, there's a lesson there somewhere, and clearly you in some respects you've taken a similar approach in terms of the material things in life, and as a result, from the sounds of it, feeling much happier and content as a result of those decisions.
Life is significantly better once you figure out, I think, the triggers ultimately. and everyone's are individual. And so I want to talk about, obviously, next week, 19th of July. Just heard from Sadiq Khan that on the tube, you still have to wear masks. But for the most part, Boris is saying that these measures are lifted. Is it Freedom Day? Is it Fear Day? What are we looking at here?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I read that question before I came on today, and I thought it's really interesting, given we're watching the news, for those of us that have TVs, we're watching the news and we're just looking at our COVID apps and we're seeing the cases rising. And look, I am one of these people who think we absolutely have to get back to normality, you know, for the state of our own well-being. Generally, we have to try and get back to normal life. But the reality is, you know, cases are, you know, rising at a rapid rate. So this virus is still there. So I think there is, I maybe speak for myself now and think, yeah, Freedom Day, I'm not as excited about it as I thought I would be. I'm kind of glad it's coming, but I am concerned with what I'm hearing about the cases rising. So I think, yeah, there are a lot of people who think this is great, but underlying are going, but there's also this risk that everyone's going to kind of lose the plot a little bit and think it's kind of okay now. So I think there is, you know, I don't think we should... I don't think we should panic. Certainly, I think it just needs us to be mindful and respectful of other people. Still, recognize there's still a virus out there, and I do think if generally the population takes that approach, we can ease a lot of the restrictions that we've had. The challenge, of course, is there will always be the minority that are not going to respect others and are going to misbehave. We've seen that, of course, at the weekend with the football. So, you know, arguably, would they have abided by the rules anyway? it's an interesting thought. So, yeah, it's a really interesting question. That Fear Day is probably extreme. I think we need to be really careful of that. Freedom Day is also extreme. I think we maybe need to rename it something like it's okay to go out day. I don't know, something like that. Probably not the best description, but yeah.
I think fear is what we've been led to live with for the last 18 months or so. And I agree on the freedom. I think that's a little bit much. It's, do you know what? We're getting there and it's getting a little bit better day by day. There's going to be spikes, there's going to be waves, but this, like so many other things out there, such as mental health issues, this is something we have to live with and deal with and contend with in our own way, I suppose. You know, just before we sign off, I guess, I'm really curious, because obviously you're a very knowledgeable young man.
Thank you, Sean.
You know, I mean, if you could go back sort of 20, 30 years, perhaps, you know, is there anything that you would have at that stage in your life picked up any different in terms of how you were living or how you were being aware of your surroundings and what was going on in the world to maybe, you know, better what the future looked like?
Yeah, it's interesting. Something I've thought about a lot, and as with Jordan's own suicide and my knowledge and you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing. Would I have done things differently? You know, people have said to me, don't beat yourself up about what's happened, but without question, knowing what I know now, which is interesting. Yeah, there were things I would have done differently, but I think, you know, at that stage we managed things with the tools we had and the knowledge we had, so I've been able to kind of deal with that. But going back 20-30 years and look at the lead up and build up to everything and what happened, you know, 19 months ago, I would like to think that I would be someone that was less focused on trying to achieve success in life. And to coin an old phrase, just stop and smell the roses a little bit more, spend more time with the kids, not worry if I got home from a busy day and the house was in a mess because the kids' toys were everywhere and everything that I recognized in my 30s that I was, certainly not a tyrant, but I, you know, there were things that used to upset me that really were quite pathetic now when I look back. And but this constant striving for material success in life, Yeah, there are things I would do very, very differently now in terms of just time with the family and maybe, I've got to be very careful of sounding cliched here, but maybe looking to do something that added more value. But that's easy to look back on now because of circumstances, age, all these things. You look back and go, wish, you know, how many people have probably reached this point in life and gone, yeah, kind of wish I'd done things differently. The message, I suppose, there, though, is it's never too late. You know, I think out of this mess, really, this awful, awful situation, and you can't describe it as anything less than that, there are good things happening. And one of the things, you know, with one of the partners I work very closely with, Paul Vittles in the legacy, and that he shared this concept from his experience of working in the zero suicide community about the work he did in Australia with people and bereaved families, and said, look, one of the things we would always do is we'd kind of end on this kind of message of hope. So out of all this, there has to be some hope. Otherwise, why are we doing this? So I certainly, you know, are seeing now through the work we're doing signs of hope and signs of change. We know we've saved lives. There's no question. You know, I've had the conversations to confirm that. No, that's kind of what inspires me and keeps me going, to say, look, there is hope. And, you know, this is the conversations I have with people who are struggling, just to say, I know you can't see it now. You know, I recognize what you're going through at the moment. It seems like there's no way out of this at all. But what I can tell you is, if you choose to go that route, it's a permanent solution to what is a temporary problem. So let's look at how, you know, we can find some way of hope for you to get out of this. And that's what we've got to do for people, is give them a bit more hope and a little less fear, really.
I think that's an incredible point. You know, a little bit more hope and a lot less fear. And, you know, going back to what you were talking about with spending more time with the family, there's a great American entrepreneur, Jesse Itzler. I don't know if you've ever come across this guy before. Talks about building his life resume rather than his work resume, and talks about, actually, you know, if you see your parents, you know, twice a year, three times a year, and let's say, you know, we estimate they've got another 10 years to live, you don't actually have another 10 years with your parents. You have, effectively, if you see them twice a year, you got another 20 visits with them.
Mm-hmm.
That puts things into a much, much different perspective when you actually appreciate that, and appreciating that spending an hour extra with the family rather than that extra hour in the bar, understanding that a 300-pound Gucci belt will hold your trousers up no differently than a 10-pound belt from the local shop from Tesco's, right? And no matter how busy those roads are, the BMW is not going to get you home any quicker than a Ford is. And it's getting to a place where you can appreciate that and live with yourself, not competing to the fact that you need to have those things. And there's a fantastic quote, which I read years ago, which for me sums up everything that I think about nowadays. I want to give you this one. And it's by Confucius. Every man has two lives. And the second one begins when he realizes he only has one. And that, to me, says everything.
Mm. Yeah. That resonates with me. Absolutely. Mm.
Is there anything that you would like to drop as your little nugget of knowledge as we sign off here, as a quote, or anything that you want to leave people with as a final?
I think really it's about, I think something I referred back to earlier on, Sean, that on December the 3rd, 2019, it had never once crossed my mind that I might get a knock on my door or a phone call to say that one of my children had taken their own lives. And the many people I've spoken to since, you know, this has happened, who said the same thing. And also what we learned about Jordan through some of the journals he left behind and things that we had no idea at all about what he was going through at certain times in his life in the lead up to that. I think it is down to us all to become better educated about mental health, particularly. Just get that basic knowledge, training, whatever it is, to understand What does it look like, both good and poor mental health? And if I understand what it looks like, maybe I'm going to be more attuned to recognize the signs in those that are around me. And if I also kind of know what to do, because when it happens, it's too late. It's too late. I wish I'd been better educated. I wish I'd known about this. So I think, you know, it doesn't take a lot of work. Just, you know, you can Google this stuff, for goodness sake, but just become better educated. Just stop and think and look around your friends, your work colleagues, your family, and just say, I kind of wonder how they're really doing. And then the important thing, of course, is to ask them regularly, but in a really authentic way where you are genuinely interested, and always make sure you ask them twice, because they're always going to say I'm fine the first time.
Very true. Very true. There's a HR director in the US that came out with a great quote a couple of years ago, and it was, people need people, and then people need people who listen, and then people need people who listen and do something about it.
Yeah, it's so true. I know, you know, my wife, bless her heart, you know, I talk about this young chap I was concerned about earlier, and she said, you know, are you taking too much on here? I said, well, so what do I do then? If I get it, do I say, well, sorry, can I just send you to Samaritans or whatever else? Or do I just try and engage this guy in conversation? And you know, if I was getting 100 a day, yeah, okay, maybe. But, you know, A, I had to care. B, I had to do something. And you know, it's, you know, that great experience from a bad situation at the weekend where everybody leapt onto that post by that person who was in trouble, and we got a solution. Just said, great, if everyone would just, you know, care and do something of a practical nature, just thinking, oh, that's sad, but actually it's not my responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, mental health is everybody's responsibility, and I think until we start to openly discuss it more, to treat it in the same way we would do if we knew someone had a physical injury, where we'd, right, let me come down, I'll help you out. And until we start getting to that level, unfortunately, we're going to lose too many good people.
Well, you know, as so many will have said to you, you know, awfully sorry for the loss that you've endured, but off the back of that, what you're able to give back to so many, in so many different ways, you know, is nothing short of incredible. So I thank you for everything you're doing. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, Sean, really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for today.